It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running. We are now officially 2 days into October 2018. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live. It is the second day of October 2018. And if you'd like to be part of the Merry Madcap Wacky Zany real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, I highly recommend and heartily invite you to pop on over to HeadOn.live, jump in the chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and password, and, you'll be immediately welcomed and greeted by the likes of Anatole and Derbert and Ken and Larry and more to wander in as the evening proceeds. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And, yeah, it's Tuesday. It's Titanic Tuesday. Remember, on Tuesdays, we celebrate the Titanic intellect always on display, courtesy of the white wing in America. It's Titanic intellect because it's the kind of intellect that says, hey, look, an iceberg, let's play chicken with it. The name of Titanic Tuesday, for those new to the program, comes from something that happened years and years and years ago now when our buddy Jim, whom we hope is okay. I haven't heard from Jim for a very, very long time. I understand he was feeling rather poorly a while back. Hope Jim's okay. But Jim was listening to White Wing Radio over in America's fifth smallest radio market, namely, and to wit, Beckley, West Virginia, when he heard a caller to the morning monotone ask him, Steve, how come it is you reckon there is seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? I done seed 'em when I was a down in the mines, and we ain't nowhere's near the beach. It don't make sense to me. To which Steve, stunning monotone that he was, the minute he started talking every morning, cars began verging off the road as drivers went to sleep and began taking out telephone poles. Traffic fatalities and traffic accidents are way down in Beckley ever since he left broadcasting. But he responded,
well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates.
Mm-hmm. The Titanic plates account for why you can see seashells in the rock strata in the mountains of underneath the mountains of Appalachia. Why, for instance, there were lots and lots of trilobites in the valley of the Great Tays River. Titanic plates. Yes. No word yet on movement of the Titanic Foley food mill, but we await that. We await that information. Brother Deacon Asa says, you're so unkind to Steve. He had to put that program on with absolutely no talent whatsoever. I know. Oh, it's been a heck of an afternoon. It's been a heck of a day. I spent the better portion of it over at the garage, getting, work done on the vehicle. There's some sort of something or another that has, over the course of its life, caused on the passenger, the front passenger side, has caused the periodically caused the calipers not to release properly and to drive the brake pad into the rotor, which has resulted in multiple rotor replacements. And so it was front brakes today, and turned rotors. And, of course, the simple little brake line that goes from the right, well, no, they ain't not, none of the parts places around here had that in stock, so it'll be here sometime tomorrow, and so we'll get to you know, it'll get in, and then I'll get to spend tomorrow afternoon there too. Is Steve from Georgia stand with the notes? Say hi to me and Duncan Meathead. Duncan Meathead. Oh, well, yes, of course. And if you do pop into the chat room, you will be greeted by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a Spacing Guild master, has chosen on another lovely Northern California day to fold space and become Man Cave. And also in there today, welcoming him back from his convalescence, and we'll probably get a concert report later this week, because he was at the Kansas concert there in Georgia last weekend. In fact, while Julius Geezer was, well, while the orangutan was haranguing the people of people in Wheeling, West Virginia, Steve was sending me photos from the Kansas concert, which looked to be just a heck of a lot more fun than any Clavern rally that Julius Geezer has ever participated in or led. So that's where all of this stands. Now let's see. There's something we have to do at the beginning of at the beginning of every broadcast. We thank our subscribers, and so thanks go out today. Thanks go out to our buddy Paul in Arizona. Thank you, Paul. Thanks go out to Clarence in somewhere between Philly and South Carolina. Thanks as well to Elizabeth in New York for being a partial sponsor of all that we try to do here. Thank you very kindly to Albert down in North Carolina. I hope you're recovering well from all the damn rains and flooding and hurricanes. Y'all have all been on my mind. Thanks also to Rocco. Thank you, Rocco. And thanks to our buddy of long, long standing, Reggie. Thank you, Reggie. We're talking here about our subscribers. And thanks to the subscribers, we managed to knock down about a quarter of what we try to fundraise every month. So thank you to all of our subscribers. And now, as for where we are this evening, thanks go out to Yuki. Thank you very kindly to Yuki, because Yuki knocked down half of tonight's fundraising goal. So that means we've only got $100 to raise. How about 10 new subscribers at $10 apiece over at headon.live at the PayPal interface, or just 10 folks with $10. And remember that that $10 means that you that keeping independent not-for-profit, not-profit-driven progressive broadcasting on the air, that $10 means that you are setting yourself back to the tune of, gosh, about a fifth of the cost of a cup of coffee from, like, Starbucks or even McDonald's. Which, when you get right down to it, is not a hell of a lot to be set back for supporting something that's here Monday through Friday, every week, 3 hours, information, the ability to reach out, have your say, all of that. Oh, I know, hung like Jesus says, it's always something, Bob, always. Yes, it is. And, well, you know, that's going to be a few $100 that just wasn't doing anything with. So instead of putting it into maybe some new hand cross-stitched placemats for the Gulfstream 5, we'll put it into the front end of the vehicle instead. Yeah. But that's true. Good to hear from you, hung like Jesus. Larry pointing out, with any luck, the shoes on the back brakes will go out soon. Four-wheel disc brakes, thank you very much, so it'll just be pads. But the pads were replaced, but the rotors do need doing. Hey, as we get started this evening, a challenge on the table, courtesy of our buddy Steve in New York. I'll do a $15 challenge, so your $15 gets turned into $30, courtesy of Steve, for anybody who jumps in on that, or 5 becomes 10, or 10 becomes 20, 15 becomes 30, up to $15. And that'll take us a little way toward that $100 goal. Oh, wow. Meanwhile, Steve from Georgistan tells me that Ms. Karen and I have third row seats to see the wonderfully, magnificently, fabulously talented Iris Dement on Friday. Steve says, I'll send pics. Oh, that's going to be a hell of a good show. That's going to be just a wonderful show. Yes, Steve, do please send pics. Checking in on a few other pieces of email. I'm waiting to hear from our buddy Jordan Deardahl Roberts. You may recall we talked a few months back. Jordan was the one who, rather than participate in the arguable crime against humanity of rounding up innocent children to put them in concentration camps, walked away from a state job in the state of Montana. I'm hoping that Jordan will be dialing in shortly. I'm looking forward to that conversation, especially given the news we had beginning last weekend about the Tent City concentration camp. And in point of fact, I believe we have Jordan now. Let me check.
Hello?
Hey, Jordan. Good to have you back with us, my friend.
Good to be back. It's been an interesting time since we last had a chance to talk.
I keep following you over on Twitter. That's where I see most of the stuff that you write. You have been active. You've been you haven't backed off on your position. Fill us in on where you've been over the last few months.
Okay, so I have been everywhere. I went around, one of the first things I had to do after quitting my job at the Department of Labor, I went to try and try my hand at freelance writing because I thought, here's a chance. Like, I've got this bit of a platform. I can maybe draw some more attention to these issues. But then more stuff happened and everybody stopped paying attention to immigration. And then I had all these stories sitting on desks that never got...
Doesn't the sort of attention deficit disorder nature of the 24-hour, which is now apparently a 15-second news cycle, just drive you to distraction?
Well, it's like, in one way, I get it. Like, we're not necessarily equipped to deal with the sort of constant thing that is happening right now with the Trump administration. People have often tried to bill it like, oh, this is his plan. He distracts you from X with Y. Like, no, he's just a garbage fire. Like, this distraction is a outcome, but it's not like he's not sitting there twirling a mustache, you know, going, ha ha, I'm going to have
I'll get you, little Nell. I'll tie you.
I'll definitely tie you to the railroad tracks, definitely.
It was a while back, I mean, a couple hundred scandals ago, when the Supreme Court had said that we could now indefinitely detain immigrants. And that same week was when the whole Stormy Daniels thing first came out. And it was like, oh, yes, this is a man who definitely planned to have this non-disclosure agreement blow up just in time to... It's like, no, that wasn't the plan. It just all keeps happening. So the news shifted, sort of went away from the freelance writing and started working more on education and activism work. I did a couple speeches in Montana. And then the month of June, I did not sleep more than 5 nights in my bed at home. I was... Seattle, met up with some folks there while attending my wife's graduation. She got a master's in library and information science, though, which is good.
Congratulations.
And then I got back. It was in Montana, went to Missoula for a gathering there about, we had a bunch of ice, grabbed a bunch of people here in front of the Missoula prison. Was like, hey, let's not hold the immigrants, like, let's not do ICE's dirty work. And then I ended up traveling to Florida, went to was visiting my grandmother who hadn't been doing well, and then went to a rally in Orlando. And then while in Florida, that was when we just started hearing about all those kids getting put in camp the first time round. Ended up kind sort of on a whim, not having a full plan, just going to Texas. Like on the way there, I was communicating with people from United We Dream. And so I joined up with them at a protest outside Tornillo, where they're now shipping the kids again.
Right.
About 300 of us shut down the border. Like, they closed the gates. And it was one of those experiences, like, because I had been, you know, when you're doing this sort of work, you can get discouraged. You don't get a lot of victories.
When you're involved in any kind of grassroots activism, Jordan, rule one is do not expect immediate gratification or instant gratification.
We were marching, this bus went by, and it was a bus with the kids in it, and so we start like hooping and hollering, and they're in the back in that bus. And we can see them jumping up and down. One kid, like, raised the power fist, like, you know. And it was – I kind of wish we could have stopped that bus, but at least these kids going in there know, like, they knew there were people fighting for them. And so I get back. I'm in Texas, and I get a call from I get a message from Michael Skolnick with Move On, and he's like, "Hey, can you come to DC?" And I had to send him a message back like, "Well, sure. I may be getting arrested, but barring that, sure." So I ended up, you know, didn't get arrested while I was in Texas. Went to D.C., did a speech on that June 30th rally, and then came home and had been just sort of trying to do some local stuff in Montana. And then United of a Dream was doing another action in Miramar, Florida. There's a ICE processing facility there where, like, people go in to do their check-ins, and they have people standing out in the sun for, you know, 10 hours a day because, you know, it was kind of first-come, first-serve-ish basis, and you'd be standing up and waiting for your turn to, and you go into this building not knowing if you're coming out. And so there was this group, they call themselves the Circle of Protection. They're just across the street, and they provide water and offer to, like, you know, watch people's kids, because you can't bring kids into the building, but, like, a lot of these people, you know, the kids going in don't necessarily know if their parents are coming out. Like, it's pretty messed up. So I was with United We Dream. We shut down the facility by blocking the intersection, got arrested, spent an evening as a, you know, guest of the Broward County jail, got back, and have been, I worked on some more local organizing efforts, trying to behave myself. While the charges are still pending, so I've got to make the attorney's job easier, I've got to play nice. And
it's always best when you can do that. Yeah, you know, make the lawyer's job, yeah, not so difficult.
Yeah. And then I got started working with some more people locally, and we have in Helena, Montana, we have a USCIS office that's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Office. And we started working on organizing the demonstration, because what's been happening, like, the ICE agents, you know, ripping, screaming children from the arms of their mothers, like, that's a very compelling image. That's something you can get people fired up about. Problem being, is there are people who, like me, or who had been like me, working behind the desk, just shuffling paperwork, and they're allowing this stuff to happen because they're just pushing paper, but that has an effect. And so I was trying to draw attention to what the USCIS does. I got a handful of people. We had a big banner, and the building is a vacant lot away from one of the busier streets in Helena. So, like, they had this big banner saying USCIS equals ICE collaborators. And it was funny. So the building that they have, they share space with Northrop Grumman. Apparently, Northrop Grumman was so nervous about us showing up, they shut down for the day.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's been my adventures, and then I've just been doing a lot of kind of running around. That's like the brief overview of just everything that's kind of been happening since. And all the while, like, everything is on fire. Like, it's been a trip.
Oh, to say the least. Well, now with the revelation that, and you mentioned Tornillo, Texas. Now with the revelation, and we talked about this some last night briefly on the program. that children are being sent literally in the dark and still and the wee hours of the night. They're being slunk and snuck off into this tent city concentration camp. Are you in contact? I mean, what are people doing? What can people do to voice their outrage about this?
Well, the people who had the most effective demonstration, because I had been down in Texas a couple days before the United Dream action, like, there was a lot of people working. Like, United We Dream is definitely the people to contact if you really want to do something. Like, they have, you know, very effective communications. They are, you know, they will tell you where to go, what to do. And it's, I had actually listened to your program from yesterday, and you were talking about, you know, I would have made a comment about, they might as well have workshops that you free across the gate. One of the previous...
Yeah, work makes y'all free.
Yeah, that one of the previous places they were putting kids back in June, there was Joy Reid had gone in when they were first touring the facility. So it gives them a, like, oh, look, we're being nice to these children. There had actually been somebody who had... put a sign up saying, you know, work hard and things will happen. So
there was a manifest. There really was a manifestation of that.
Yeah. So we're not like, we're pretty close to the line. It's so bizarre because, I mean, back in February when I quit, we were not here yet. Like, things were bad, but we had not quite gone into the, you know, putting kids in camps area yet. I mean, I thought we were going, which was part of why I couldn't just play along. And it's been really difficult to sort of, you know, wrestle with this stuff. I mean, things have gotten pretty bad, but it's funny because I actually went back and listened to the first time I was on your show, because I wanted to, you know, make sure I wouldn't repeat myself too much, or if there was something else that needed to be corrected. It's been, like, good, because when I talked to you, I was still learning about the situation that made me quit. So, because I had made a comment about how, oh, the Department of Labor has a legal obligation because, you know, if you have a subpoena signed by a judge, you know, you're legally compelled to provide that information. And this might be a little technical, but there's a difference between a judicial subpoena and what it turns out they were getting was an administrative subpoena. So an administrative subpoena is just basically one agency asking the other, hey, can we have this information? So what the state of Montana has been doing is we're just handing them information without them having to go before a judge, which may actually be in violation of the Montana state constitution. Montana is one of the 10 states that has a right to privacy enshrined in the state constitution. You're not supposed to release personal information without a compelling state interest, and we're just giving it away. So that's one of the fights I've been having. I actually spoke to our governor about that. Like, when back, you know, when I, a little bit after I quit, I spoke to him and said, like, you know, can we change the way we're doing this? And he, you know, smiled and nodded and was like, well, I mean, I'm being told we're doing it the right way. And it's really frustrating because right now, I don't know if news has gotten out your way, because he's been going to all those places you go when you want to maybe run for president. You know, he's showing up in Iowa fairs and all that jazz.
Yeah, that's usually one of the giveaways. When a politician is caught in the immediate vicinity of corn dogs in Iowa or near butter sculptures or things, that's a sign.
Yeah, so he's doing that. But to me, like, I don't think we need people who are, we don't need necessarily like the Avenatti, like fight fire with fire. You don't need to, you don't put that sort of guy in charge. It's nice to have that sort of person on your side to like flip the tables, but you need people in charge to have some understanding of what they're doing. But I also don't think you need somebody who's like too worried about not being liked. I think like Alex is a nice guy, but that's kind of the problem. He's a nice guy. He likes being liked. I don't think he's going to rock the boat too much. And so it's funny watching him start running and like we've talked. I know that he and it's I wasn't the only one who's gone to him asking about this. So it's really frustrating that nothing happens. And now I'm working with state legislators. I'm like, hey, can we maybe get this enshrined in law, pass a bill? Because one of the state legislators here, Marianne Dunwell, she had been to this conference where she had these ICE agents out there talking about how they won't go, they don't go to states that require judicial subpoenas. They have to report a judge before requesting this information. They just don't do it because it's too much work.
Oh, great! Laziness as a laziness as a defense. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's not like finding a judge who will sign off on it, especially in a state like Montana. It's not like that's a big ask. It's not like you're asking them to bring the ring to Mount Doom sort of mission. Go for a judge and say, hey, we want this information because we think people in such and such business are undocumented. Problem being, a lot of that is usually like they're working off tips, and those tips tend to be, somebody goes to a restaurant and says, "Wow, there are a lot of brown people working here," and that's their tip they're working off of. So that's how you can actually come to an end, they might sign off on it.
Well, hey, Jordan, let me interrupt for just a minute.
Yeah.
I want to. We're having some audio issues with what you're saying, and I don't know if it's a cell phone thing or. So, if you don't mind, let us. I gave you two numbers. Try the other number. And let's see if maybe your audio quality is a little bit better. So I will talk to you in a second. Dial back on the 304-574-8178 number. Sorry about that. The stress line's been pretty bulletproof lately. And I don't know if this is, I don't know if this is, to be quite honest, cell service is often not as good as old-fashioned landlines used to be. So hopefully we'll hear back from Jordan in a second or so. Let's see here.
My phone didn't like your other number, so I don't know what's up with that.
That's really bizarre. I never even saw it ring through here.
It said Verizon Wireless will not let you complete this call, so I don't know.
I wonder
if it.
It's Verizon. Then everything makes sense now.
That is one of the problems out here in Montana.
But your audio is significantly better now. So whichever, if you're standing on one leg and got one arm in the air and got your tongue sticking out of your mouth, just so don't move.
Okay, won't move.
It's a lot better. It's a lot better than it was. Given what we know now, and you're right, it kind of blows my mind that you and I were carrying on that conversation in February.
Yeah.
That was almost exactly 8 months ago. And you, in terms of the timeline, yeah. It would be a few more months before we found out that children were being kidnapped from their parents and kept in animal cages, and that the government itself, which can track all kinds of things, but apparently not children separated from their parents. It would be a while before we saw just how nefarious that the entire program was. And you, in turn, became somewhat prophetic by virtue of the stance that you took. Obviously, I mean, you're bound to be comfortable with the decision that you made.
You know, it was one of those things, every time something else happened, it was like, boy, am I sure glad I made the right choice when I did. Because I can't imagine what I would have felt for myself had I just passed along the information and then all this had happened. It'd be like, wow, you really blew that one. It's, and I just can't understand now why there are so many people still carrying this out. Like,
well, let me ask you this. Of course, there's a universal law that says no good deed goes unpunished. Are you doing okay? Are you and your wife and your baby doing all right?
So Julie Briskin had started the GoFundMe. We're still working out of that. My wife's been got her degree. It was funny when she started this whole thing. There was plenty of library jobs in Montana, but then the last session, the Republican cut all the funding, so there's the library jobs kind of dried up. So she's been doing some consulting work. We're not in danger yet. We might be getting there if something doesn't change. But I occasionally question sometimes the effectiveness of what I've done, because it just feels like there's so few wins we have. But I don't regret quitting my job. Like, there's no, you know, zap me back to that point in time, I'd have still done it.
Sure, because you have to live with your own conscience. But from what you described, you've been kind of traveling, and you've experienced the helter-skelter nature of grassroots activism. Is there a plan for what's next in terms of, I mean, there are court challenges and civil disobedience. Where is the movement for the children going right now?
I think right now there are so many people kind of shocked by it, because there was a court decision a while back that said Trump had to reunite these families. And we are, I think, 60 or more days out from that. And so he was supposed to be reuniting these kids with their parents. And they had reunited, I think, about 1,000 children, and there were a number of them still in detention, and they kept going, and they said, oh, we can't reunite these kids. And now they're putting more kids in these camps. It's what we need is another, like, march on that facility.
But by putting it out literally in a vast wasteland, they were effective, were they not, in making it rather difficult to engage in civil disobedience?
Yeah, because when I was there with United We Dream, we'd actually, several of us were, we were blocking the entrance to the camps, and it basically kind of became a siege. And well, it was, when I was down there, we're talking triple degree heat. So, like, you know, keeping everybody properly watered in that weather is a bit difficult. So yeah, they put it out there in such a way that it's not just that, though, because what they're doing is they're on federal land, which puts them outside the state's purview. Because if you're holding children on in a state facility, you have to follow certain guidelines, and you will be inspected by inspectors. But since they're on federal land, they're outside that. So, I mean, they know what evil they're doing. They've planned this.
Oh, without a doubt, and geared entirely toward evading federal laws and federal regulations. One of the things that's most disturbing out of the revelations regarding Tornillo, Texas, and the concentration camp in the Tent City concentration camp there, is the fact that the children have no formal education now.
Yep.
And very limited access to any sort of children's advocates, lawyers, anything like that.
When I was in, when I did my speech in D.C., the person, one of the people who I met there was this Dr. Amy Cohen. She was a child psychologist. And one of the things she said during her speech was, we're going to be on the hook for the care of these children afterwards. Because what we are doing right now is psychological torture. So I had... I've explained to people that, like, you know, my childhood was not great. I was removed from the custody of my mother, and I was placed in a shelter for a while. And where I was placed was at least with people who seemed like they cared. Now, you put that many traumatized kids in a small, contained area, like, there's going to be some trouble. But, like, for the most part, the people there seem to care. That's the sort of environment we are now pulling these kids out of in group homes and shelters and putting them in these camps with people who I can't assume have these children's best interests at heart. I mean, they're being guarded over by, like, you know, ICBP agencies, people who, you know, are willing to do this work. And I don't know if there was a while back,
morally, here, let's go ahead and say it, morally compromised, ethically challenged enough to be willing to do that in order to get a paycheck.
Yeah.
Can we just take a moment with this, Jordan? Can I ask, and if I'm wrong for saying it, you feel free to push back.
Yeah.
What is wrong with somebody that they would be willing to work in a concentration camp for children? Think of this as my own little private Nuremberg questions.
Oh no, I've been saying that the people who are doing this now, when, like, let's say everything in November goes out like gangbusters and we have this huge blue wave, we need to start calling for a Nuremberg style like trial of the people who carried this out, because you don't want these people working with children, with immigrants. Like, if they're willing to be this inhumane, that's really scary. And, I mean, there was a while back, there was one person who had worked at one of these shelters, Anatar Davidson, I think was his name. He had resigned after he was told to stop these brothers from hugging. Like, so there are people working there who see this as a problem. So my hope is not entirely lost. And like I might understand someone who works in like direct care, working directly with kids, who thinks if I go, they're just going to replace me with somebody really monstrous. And I mean, part of it was in that New Yorker article, I mean, they had people who talked under the condition of anonymity about how bad things were, but I'm definitely not thinking like the guy whose job it is to open and close the gate. Like I think about that sort of person. But what that person gets to do is they get to say, "Well, I'm just opening and closing the gate. That's all I'm doing. I'm just hitting the button, the gate opens. Hitting the button, the gate closes."
And I know you are you're a reader and you're well read. I think of there's a passage from Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago, And he says basically, you know, when do you refuse? When do you protest? Is it when they take your belt? Is it when they take your shoelaces? Is it when they tell you that you won't get dinner tonight because you didn't comply? All of these things, Solzhenitsyn says, add up to monstrous crimes.
Yeah.
But they only, you know, they only, they take place incrementally. I mean,
had Trump said, like, you know, day one of his administration, they're putting kids in camps, people would have lost it. And we would have what we actually need, which would be, you know, people taking to the streets and not leaving. But it's, yeah, it's happened incrementally. And I've been asking people, like, what would it take for you to join something like a general strike or just start rioting in the streets? And I think people need to ask themselves that question. Like, what's your line too far? The problem being is we're so far in it now that people need to ask themselves that question, you know, when Trump announced, you know, his candidacy. Because he started with some eliminationist rhetoric, the stuff you hear every time we are marching towards gas chambers. And because you had said, you know, back when this was first going on, how, you know, people started reacting. I was in this meeting locally with some people trying to plan sort of a local action. And someone had, when they were first separating these kids, with this kind of negligent, like this purposeful negligence about not reconnecting these kids with their parents. Like that whole thing, like when you go to Chuck E. Cheese, they stamp the kid with something and the parent with something, and like it's the same number. Like,
so that you can make sure. Yeah. Like, Chuck E. Cheese can do this.
Yeah, like our government was outclassed by Chuck E. Cheese, and I said they don't plan to reunite these kids. And someone said, "What do you think they're going to do with them?" And I said, "People loving," and they were shocked. You need to, and then there were people there who were saying, oh, well, we need to make sure these are nice facilities. And no, like that.
Yes, we need to make sure that these are appropriately decorated concentration camps, that they're homey concentration camps, that they're warm and comfortable concentration camps.
And, I mean, there were plenty of, you know, warm and cozy looking concentration camps in the front, but in the back there was the walls with the bullet holes. Like, making this look slightly okay is not what we need to do. We need to not be putting kids in camps. We do not need to be putting families in camps. We need to actually have immigration that, like, one of the things I've been trying to tell people, because trying to get people on board with immigration in, you know, white rural areas like Montana, sometimes is a bit of a haul, but I keep telling people, like, if you actually want to stop illegal immigration, make immigration legal. We have put so many barriers in the way, just ridiculous mountains people have to climb.
Right, but Jordan, you can't have a legitimate and honest conversation about immigration in this country, because every time you say, well, you know, we need to take a hard look at the laws, we need to see, you know, what the future needs of our country are. We need to see what the workforce needs of our country are. We need to make sure that children who were brought here are not held accountable for the actions of their parents. And you can go through a list like this that is cogent and reasonable. And what you get from the other side, from the birthers and deathers and baggers and birchers and booger eaters and maggots and Trumpansies and Republicans generally, is open borders. There is absolutely no way. And by God, the white wing knows it, Jordan. There is absolutely no way to carry on a public policy debate when one side is talking about ideas and the other side is grunting like Og the fucking caveman.
And, you know, it's funny because people talk about that open borders thing. Like, it's this horrible things. Like that was immigration policy when we started, where, I mean, everyone wants to talk about, you know, I mean, with, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, the originalist.
Well, the original, you know, the colonization of this hemisphere is basically open borders. Hey, white people, come on over and steal some land. And as I've said before, I know this to be a fact because that's how long my family's been here.
Yeah.
We were some of the original land thieves.
But even if you wanted to, like, people are worried about, like, border security. But if we had immigration, like, what people are supposed to be able to do is show up at these points of entry and present themselves. And Trump has screwed with that awfully. But let's pretend he said, okay, if you show up at these places, we will, you know, either get you, like, you know, barring you being, like, an actual violent criminal, not this idea that, like, they're all violent criminals, but, like, an actual violent criminal, or that you're not literally carrying the plague, like, we'll figure out a way. If we did that and people could come, then if you wanted your secure border, then if anybody was crossing anywhere where you said, like, outside, you know, these areas where you can come, then, okay, if they're crossing here, they're obviously coming here for something nefarious. Now, granted, we'd also have to deal with our drug problem, because, I mean, that's, like, if we were...
Right, and see, no offense, I mean, but you're doing it again. You're engaging in a reasonable discussion of what it means to have national borders, and somewhere, because, you know, they outnumber us by about 1,000 hours to 1, the white wing does. Somewhere out there, there's a maggot, and he's, oh, goddamn liberals just want open borders, and we're going to be up to our eyebrows and brown people, and then it won't be Merkel anymore, Gerberger.
It is really frustrating.
And that's, you know, and the thing is, the people who are grunting into microphones like that are, you know, they've got massive platforms. They're your Flush Flemballs and your Savage Wieners and your Hannity Jobs. And, well, I don't know what's going on with Alex Jones, but... they've got the ear of a lot of people who don't know better. And you're absolutely right. If you start talking immigration with white people in Montana or, you know, white people in West Virginia, it doesn't really touch them, except for the fact that they have had they've had the hate and paranoia center of their tiny little lizard brains diddled.
But I hate to do this sort of economic argument because I think that gets away from actually talking about people's humanity, but sometimes, like, you have to meet certain people where they are. And, I mean, if you've looked at, like, you know, your grocery bill going up because we have scared away migrant workers, not undocumented workers, just migrant workers are afraid to go into the field, even if they're documented. Because ICE isn't that great right now with checking paperwork. They're checking your skin tone before they haul you off. So, you know, the reason your celery and your head of lettuce cost more now is because there's nobody who is going to pick that now. And we've scared away migrant workers. And it's funny, people think of that work as unskilled labor. And no, it takes a certain amount of skill to do that job right. And we're scaring away everybody who knows how to do it. And we're going to pay hard for that.
And meanwhile, I have yet to see any white folks from West Virginia or any of the other maggot states saying, I sure do want to spend my life a picking of the lettuce and the tomatoes.
The idea that, you know, they're coming for your job. One, I think we have to have a, okay, I know I'm getting into that space again where I started talking about this in an honest debate. But like, we have to get into this talk about like what work's going to look like in a couple years when there's much more automation and all that. Like, it's definitely a discussion to be had. But there are certain jobs like that, that like, until we get, you know, much further technologically, like picking vegetables.
Well, see, Jordan, this rolls back to what I was saying about, you know, not having to educate the little kids in the concentration camps. If you listen to yesterday's program, you know that I spent an inordinate amount of time on an extraordinarily stupid human being who goes by the name of The. Now, he's changed his name to The. Talking about Kanye West.
Yeah.
But they talk, the maggots do talk amongst themselves, and I'm convinced that there's a certain amount of there's a little bit of a tell in his bizarre rant about abolishing the 13th Amendment.
Yeah.
Because I see these kidnapped children as a potential labor pool of slaves.
You know.
And if you take that and you couple it with the pay scale for people picking tomatoes and lettuce and celery and whatnot, they're already working for damn near indentured servitude wages. Well, no, damn near, that's what they are.
Yeah, their wages, and it's funny because that's something we could fix with, like, right now our farm subsidies are all screwed up, but like if we were to subsidize, you know, farm labor and pay people. There's I'm blanking on her name, and I feel really bad about it, but there's a woman in Montana who runs this migrant worker health organization. And essentially what they do is, because the workers aren't paid enough, they essentially provide free, you know, health care to the workers. And, I mean, the farmers here love her because when you provide your labor force with healthcare, like, they can do more work. I mean, I know we're talking like the evil socialism right now, but it's so we really do need to do something about that. But I like, that's not going to happen under this administration. That there's no way that one day Donald Trump is going to wake up and suddenly see the light. It's not going to happen.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm sorry. There was a little bit of a pregnant pause there, but just no. because where Donald Trump is concerned, you have to start. There's no other way to start than with the simple statement, Donald Trump is a white supremacist. It's irrefutable, it's unavoidable, it's horrifying, it's disgusting, it's revolting, and it is also a fact, Jordan.
Oh, it's a fact. And do you remember, you know, 800 scandals ago when people were talking about the pivot?
Oh,
he's gonna become more presidential. People have stopped saying that.
Oh, no. See, I tuned in Saturday night just because Steve from Georgistan reminded me. So I went and I found the live stream of him grunting and barking in front of a crowd in Wheeling, West Virginia, wherein he declared, you know, it's so easy to be presidential. I can be presidential, but it's not very much fun to be presidential. And I would just bore you all. And that's, and that is part of it. He has shown a couple of times when he's been described as subdued over the last couple of weeks. My personal opinion is those are the days that they got the dosage right. But he enjoys whipping his crowds into white, and I do mean white, hot frenzies.
Yeah. I do think, like, Republicans have definitely for a fairly large chunk of recent history not been great. They've sort of had this idea of, there was the kind of good Republican, good with like as much air quotes as you can manage over the radio. And they had this base that they were always sort of feeding them some red meat, but then like not actually going full bore on the whole hardcore white supremacy, the Southern strategy. It's like, okay, we'll give them this. I think really what happened, which is why when people talk about like things have changed, like, no, this is not a departure, this is an endpoint, is that you can't raise a generation on that and then be surprised when those people you've been telling this white supremacy but soft sell it for a long time, like they're going to eventually run for positions in government themselves. And so, I mean, this is when we got like the hardcore Tea Party people who got voted in. And now Stephen Miller is in the White House. Like, I mean, we're straight up Nazi in the White House.
So, the technical term for Stephen Miller, if you want to be historically accurate, would be, I think, if I recall correctly, you don't call him a Nazi per se, you call him a Sonderkommando. Those were the Jews in the camps who helped their brother and sister Jews into the ovens.
But it's going to be interesting because, like, one of the things when you look at white supremacy, it's who gets counted as white. I have Italian ancestry, and for a while, Italians were considered white. They were, you know.
Oh, every immigrant group has gone through a period of not being white until they were here long enough to be considered to be white. Remember that the Klan, for instance, it was born out of a racist insurgency following the Civil War, but eventually they got around to expanding their hate beyond people of color to hating Jews, hating Italians, hating Catholics, hating Greeks, anybody who was not as lily white as they perceived themselves to be. You can go and find mid 19th century cartooning that depicts Irish people as apes.
And it's funny to watch the history of when those groups get folded into whiteness. And I mean, it's why when people sit there and talk about, well, why can people have black pride, but when I say white pride, and again, it's that, you know, they're not actually engaging with it intellectually. It's a theorist talk, but that's because, you know, black people, their culture was destroyed because he stole a bunch of people from various places and shoved them in here and did all this stuff. And then when it comes to whiteness, you don't hear, like, it's fine. And we have entire parades about Italian ancestry and Irish ancestry. Here in Montana, we have Butte, which is more Irish than Boston.
I had no idea.
Oh, it's like, it's very Irish. St. Patrick's Day there, I've never gone because I don't know if I would make it out. Like, they go all out. So it's, you know, but these, you know, you can have that pride in that sort of ancestry, but the whole white pride is not a pride in anything unifying. Like, it's a hate thing, and it's really bizarre to watch people, you know, post their memes on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, talking about, you know, white pride should be just as okay as black pride. And it's like, no, you're not understanding the difference. But again, it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between the rubes and the people pulling the strings with that sort of stuff. Like, there's people who argue that stuff, and they're not arguing genuinely. They're just spouting off because, you know, the wingnut welfare, when like they get on. I mean, have you seen the GoFundMe for Brett Kavanaugh's family?
Oh Jesus, it's sickening. Yeah,
I mean, these are people who are already they don't need the money. And there are people who are just so stirred up that they're the supposedly economically anxious are giving money as like a bounty almost. It's sick.
Yeah, it is. And oh God, you've mentioned Brett Kavanaugh, so that means that trick bag has been opened. And that's enough. But that's another part of the larger puzzle, is that there's a reason they're so eager to have him on the court. I mean, there are actually qualified nominees who don't have allegations of rape in their past, Jordan.
Yeah,
who are more right-wing than Brett Kavanaugh. But Brett Kavanaugh has the right pedigree because of the dirty business that he did as one of the elves back in the Ken Starr days, and the dirty business that he did in the Reign of Error with Dim Leader, and his predilection for catapulting power and influence and money over the needs and rights of actual living, breathing, no kidding human beings. And that includes immigration. It also includes in his time on the court, he has ruled against people and for poisoners and polluters 91% of the time in those cases.
Mm-hmm. I was making it's a bit rough here in Montana. I've been making phone calls and knocking on doors for John Tester and Kathleen Williams. And while John Tester literally has an endorsement from the Border Patrol Union, but he is by far much better than the guy running against him, Matt Rosendale. But I was making phone calls, and I mean, there are some people who are so angry that he finally came out against Kavanaugh. And he started his statement. He didn't get to the he eventually mentions the allegations, but that's from the bottom of his statement. It starts out talking about, you know, his views on privacy, you know, and siding with the corporations against working people. And they've gotten that messaging down really well, because it was one of the things someone repeated to me, that whole like, well, I've got sons and I'm worried that, like, if we just start believing women.
Oh gosh, have you taught your sons not to rape? When your sons were like little bitty toddlers, did you teach them to keep their hands to themselves and mind their own business?
But that messaging has worked, because I mean, it's something I keep hearing from people here who are like, oh.
Oh no, it's been catapulted into the Izonka sphere by Donald Trump in the last 24 hours. It's a very scary time for young men today.
Women are doing great. Really? It sort of feels like we have passed through the looking glass. Things are just so bizarre right now. I was I've been working on sort of writing my life down, and it's one of those things I keep running into.
It's a good project.
Well, it's sort of asking myself why there's not more people who said no. Like, is it something, you know, what led to that? But in trying to sort of describe crazy, you start to sound crazy. I mean, trying to even describe what happens in the news, it's hard even make it make sense, because it's just, you know, every day there's this brand new set of garbage fires, and it really I understand it wears people down, but I do think we do need more people to step up now. And I've gotten in arguments with certain people who are like, oh, you're saying, you know, don't vote. Like, where are you getting that? But no, go out and vote. Like, vote. Register people to vote. Knock on doors. But
and
also,
then stay active after you vote.
Yes. Like, because I think even if we get the, again, the huge blue wave, especially with like those kids in the camps, it's going to, unless we make enough noise, even our progressive Congress is going to wait a while to get there. Cause there's going to be, oh, there's all this other stuff. Like, no, we need to get those kids out. Cause what we're like, the things we're doing to them now are going to stick with them.
And they will haunt this nation.
It's reactive attachment disorder is what we're doing. And it messes you up. Cause I mean, I've talked a bit about how my childhood was very chaotic, and you take people, you take children, you put them through that. I mean, it was a little bit, I think, before I quit, where I'd been in therapy. And then my wife and I had been married almost 10 years. And I mean, in our household, the biggest argument, like the biggest point of disagreement between us is she cuts her sandwiches diagonally. I cut them, you know, straight up and down. That like, we're...
Well, you're just wrong.
I'll have to tell her that. She'll enjoy that. But like that's...
I mean, you get, you know, when you cut the sandwich diagonally, you get a better approach to the sandwich because you get to start at the pointy part, and then you can work your way around, and the sandwich stays together better. What the hell's wrong with you, Jordan?
Child of neglect. But I had, you know, that's the for the most part, my wife and I have been on the page about everything. But like, I had to go through like years of therapy and being in this marriage to realize like that my wife loves me in such a way that like if I have something I want to say, I don't have to worry she's just going to leave me. And so what we're doing to these kids is ruining their ability to trust anyone. And so even if we, let's say we do get the huge blue wave, let's say we put enough pressure on Congress to enact some sort of broad psychiatric care, what will these children and their families trust the U.S. government enough to do that? I can't see it happening. You know, it's really tragic and so pointless. There's no reason for it, and it breaks my heart.
Well, for good reason, because you have a functioning conscience. And and that's part of the whole self-care aspect of grassroots activism. I don't know if you've had anybody invite you to a self-care seminar yet.
I haven't had that, but I've been doing a lot of reading. There was a book called Trauma Stewardship, which had a lot of good advice. I just need to learn to follow it.
Well, that's always the challenge, because as you know, as I've said, and God knows heard more than I've said, people who are activists inside their communities because of various and sundry bad things that are happening to their communities don't get to turn it off at 5 o'clock. It's there with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. And it is really, really difficult to get away from. You can't hide from it. And if you're in it for the right reasons, it travels with you, and you have to have coping strategies so that it doesn't just consume you, because the bad actors, the poisoners, the executives for the coal companies and the chemical companies, and they turn it off at 5 o'clock, and they go home and they live these bifurcated lives where they're upstanding members of the community when they're not at work. But when they're at work, they are merciless, ruthless pursuers of profit at all costs.
This reminds me of a quote, and really I love this quote from Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. Because it talks about, because they are so much more effective. It really is scary. He said, it is a strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively, I'm coming to feel that people of ill will have used time much more effectively than people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. And it, every day, it feels like the people who are tearing things apart, they are moving at lightning speed. And when you're trying to do good, it just takes forever to make the positive changes. And it's frustrating. And yeah, they
it will take a toll on you. I mean, I've been an activist for the better part of this century. In relation to what goes on here in Appalachia relative to the coal industry. And I've you stay at it long enough and you'll see people that you love and respect pass away without having achieved your goal. And that's hatefully painful. And you have to guard against the inclination, the temptation to say, well, you know, we're never going to win. The water that rolls over the jagged stone and is slowed by that stone thinks, if water can be said to think, that it's always going to be that way, but you give it a few million years, and suddenly that stone is a rounded, flattened pebble. And so, you know, every now and then, a grain of that stone comes loose on its way to being smoothed by the water flowing over it. And we have to learn. We have to have the patience of the stream, and not the intransigence of the stone. The stream wins.
After I had done a demonstration in front of the USCIF office, I had sort of taken a step back to reassess, and I fell into a bit of a depression because I had been just running around so much that I was sort of ahead of it, and like I'm doing better now, but yeah, it's that like my grandmother had passed away, and it was, I mean, she was ready to go, like.
But it still leaves a hole.
Yeah, it still leaves. And so it was, I mean, she was not like super left. She was fairly center, but she had said she was proud of what I was doing because she was like, you don't do that to families. And so, you know, I haven't had what I would say I could nail down as like, here is a solid victory. And yeah, it is because we don't like, that's not necessarily going to be how it happened. It is going to be slow. But I really appreciate the analogy you had there, the metaphor there, because it worked, but we do have to be patient. It's just, boy, is it frustrating.
And the one thing the stream does is it continues to flow. And the rock just sits there. And I think it's a really good analogy for action. You keep doing what you're doing, and you keep working on new ideas and new strategies, and you keep networking with other people of like mind and goodwill. And every step you take are steps that others are taking with you. Sometimes you're doing the walking for others. Sometimes the others do the walking for you, or the flowing, as it were.
And I mean, I've got a, because I don't think I can do another arrest. I have severe sleep apnea, which doesn't, like, I stop breathing when I sleep, so, like, without a machine, so, like, that's the thing that makes it difficult, but, like, also, like, for, like, a week after getting arrested, like, I had to do some more therapy for dealing with the anxiety of that. So it's definitely, I don't think it's a sustainable model for me, but we do need more people willing to step up. People who
well, look, I mean, there's Jordan, there is a broader discussion over the efficacy of getting arrested. I think it's appropriate in some instances. In others, I think not so much. Because what you do when you're, among other, you know, there's a big difference between, say, Dr. King in Birmingham and other examples. Because one of the things that happens is that when you have mass arrests, you have massive amounts of money flowing into the coffers of your oppressor.
Yeah, and I do think that demonstration. Meanwhile, we did get the mayor, because they had a very clear United We Dream had a very clear ask. They were asking the mayor to pull the permit for the facility. And he got, like, 4,000 some odd phone calls that day. Now, he opted not to listen, but there's this continuing discussion. So, like, I do feel like, yeah, sometimes it's just throwing money into the system, which is why, like, I mean, this sort of gets into that whole thing about cash bail and...
Yeah, and what used to be known as catch and release and that sort of thing. Some people are into it. I think there are some people who just like to do that thing. But I would also suggest that the spirit and the intelligence that you bring to it, that doesn't have to be, you know, let you know, people have to do their thing. And, you know, you got to do your thing too. And that doesn't have to be your thing. You're still pursuing education. I believe when we talked before, you said you and your wife had an agreement when she got done, you'd go for yours. Things like that. Yeah. There's work for you to do, and you kind of sometimes you have to just go and wash your rice bowls, as the saying goes. And let things fill in around you until you sense that direction that you need to be traveling in. And let me say something, because you've been very generous with your time and we've had a lovely conversation. This is a radio show and what have you, but it's also a community, Jordan. And you're welcome here anytime. You don't have to contact me and say, "Hey, can we talk?" You can pick up the phone during the program, and we will talk. That's the nature of this thing that we've invented here over the course of the last decade and a half that we call conversation radio.
You are absolutely
welcome here at any time.
I will definitely make an effort, because it feels good to have a community. It really does.
Well, so far it has proven to be it is good. Both, God knows, it gets me from day to day, and I get a lot of communications from members of the community who say, "Yeah, this is why Tuesday becomes Wednesday for me." So I'm quite satisfied with whatever, you know, whatever mission or whatever need that this community is filling here. And having said that, I mean, do you have any idea going forward what your plan is, what your strategy is? I mean, your wife's got her degree now. Might y'all be leaving Montana? You know, Frank Zappa said, "I may be moving to Montana soon." Might y'all be leaving Montana soon? Do you know?
I would hate to do that, because when it comes to especially immigration issues here in Montana, most of the immigrants in Montana just want, they come here for the quiet, and they can't necessarily step forward without putting a target on their back. And so I want to stay here and fight as much as I can. what that necessarily looks like in the future. But I'm still trying to figure out. I'm working with a nonprofit that's broke, Montanans for Immigrant Justice.
Yeah, they often are.
Yeah, I'm trying to get them funded so we can get movement here. And I've really come to love this place. Like I moved out here a decade ago. My wife's from here. Her family's here. It's got, outside of dealing with some of the very, very right-wing people, it's a lovely place. And if there was a particular opportunity to do good work somewhere else, I'd consider it. But I would like to stay here. And, I just don't know what the work's going to look like in a couple months. We'll see.
I understand. Well, keep us posted, Jordan, and thank you for reaching out to me. I really appreciate it. And as we move into the cold weather months, and it's probably getting cooler up there than it is down here, even now. I wish you the best, and please stay in touch. Please do.
I will. I'm working on it.
All right, Jordan Dierdall Roberts. Thank you so very much for your time, and have a good evening.
You too.
All right. Bye now. Jordan Dierdall Roberts of Montana, the man who put his entire future at risk rather than participate in a program that we now have seen turned into a nightmare monstrosity of incarcerated children kept in cages, children kidnapped from their parents. And before it was ever even a thing, before it was ever really, really in most of our consciousnesses, Jordan saw what was coming, and in an act of what I consider to be profound patriotism, walked away from it and refused to be a part of it. One of these days, when there is an accounting for all the evil that has been done by this regime, I hope that Jordan Dierdall Roberts is noted as having been an early voice of dissent and resistance against something that is just manifestly hateful. We are at the halfway point of the evening, and I have happy news to report. Thank you very kindly to Larry, and thank you very kindly to Matt in San Francisco. Our buddy Steve from New York put a challenge on the table. Matt wrote and said, I'll take that challenge, $15 from East Coast to West Coast. Thank you, Matt, and thank you, Larry. That means that we got $60 to go in an hour and a half now. We've got $60 to go to keep up with fundraising for the first 2 days of this month. Six new subscribers would be awesome. Just click the little box that says, make this happen on a monthly basis or whatever it says there when you go to headon.live and click the PayPal link. Or sign up for a subscription to Patreon. Either one is fine. But in this case, we've got $60 to go to finish the evening. Thank you, Matt. And thank you very kindly to Larry. And thank you, Steve, in New York, for making the challenge. This is certainly not... This is not part of the previous topic. But it does have an element of resistance to it. You remember when I first brought to our attention this presidential alert text message thingy, and it was postponed? Well, the presidential alert test, the test of the presidential alert system has been rescheduled to tomorrow, the third day of October, at 2:18 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's 1:18 Central, 12:18 Mountain, and 11:18 Pacific. According to FEMA, and FEMA is the one that will be sending the alert. Not the syphilitic Caesar. FEMA will be sending it, but of course FEMA. The head of FEMA is a maggot. a maggot in apparently a lot of trouble because he has abused the system every bit as much as many of the other maggot cabinet members. That alert will go out at 2:18 p.m. Eastern Time tomorrow, and it will reach, according to FEMA, something on the order of 200 million U.S. cell phones. Verizon, for instance, has said that all of their phones will be able to receive the presidential alert test. The message will read as follows. Where'd it go?
This is a test of the National Wireless Emergency Alert System. No action is needed.
And then they'll send out a separate alert on TV and radio stations at 2:20 p.m. You can't do anything about those. But you can do something about having your telephone violated by the Trump administration tomorrow at 2:18 p.m. Eastern Time. Apparently, phones that, or at least some phones, if they are in the middle of a call that lasts 30 minutes, won't get the alert. A person on a call lasting 30 minutes may not get the alert as with phones with an active data connection. So, as an act of resistance, wouldn't it be sort of neat? And I know this probably marks me out as just a big old curmudgeonly asshole, but hey, since when, you know, right. That's true. Obligatory Star Trek reference coming from Lee in New York. FEMA alert. Because this is not Star Trek, it cannot be a red alert. Because it is under Trump, it must be an orange alert. Well played, sir. Well played. But if you had social media being social media, would it be possible to create a movement for millions of people in this country to make sure that they had their phones tied up for 30 minutes around the time of the emergency alert? Call your buddy, call your mom, call your dad, call your son, your daughter, your niece, your aunt, your nephew, at about, say, 2:15 p.m., and just stay on the phone for 30 minutes so that FEMA will not have the satisfaction of knowing that it has a system in place now whereby the President of the United States, who is barking fucking mad, can reach your telephone at his whim. Now, to be fair, the wireless emergency alert system that we do have, according to Reuters, has sent out something like 36,000 alerts for things like missing children, extreme weather, natural disasters, going back to 2012. But that system has never been deemed to be a situation in which the President of the United States could issue a directive. What the people in the maggot government hope for is that they'll reach 225 million cell phones in the United States. They're going for a rate of around 75%. And the only hope you have of not getting it is to be on the phone for 30 minutes at the time that the alert goes through. So, for instance, tomorrow at, say, 2:15 p.m. I've already set myself up an alert. I will use the stress line to call my personal phone, and Agnes will call Margie, and we will tie up as many of our phones, and we will keep them tied up for 30 minutes in the hopes of not receiving this little proto-dictatorial effort at testing the ability of Chlamydia Claudius to catapult the propaganda. Jack in Shreveport says, what a convenient way for Agent Orange to give the go-ahead to the maggot gun freaks to activate their arsenals and turn the cold Civil War hot. Message every maggot at one time on a minute's notice, maybe with some kind of dog whistle code. That's just, Jack says, my mind trying to find the worst-case scenario for this phone thing. Well, you don't have to look far. Giving the President of the United States that kind of reach, if the President is, say, a normal human being, and understand, of course, the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini is neither normal nor a human being. He's some sort of adipose jiggling blob of matter that probably comes from some hellscape corner of the universe, or maybe from another universe altogether. You know, where all the beings have mouths like a cat's ass. Who knows? But it would be that's civil disobedience with no penalty. And maybe if they don't reach the 75% they think they need to reach, they might get the idea that, well, no, let's don't. Because, now, here's the weird part. This actually goes back to something that Barack Obama signed into law in 2016. It requires FEMA to create a system that would let the president send cell phone alerts regarding public safety emergencies broadly to the people of the United States. This is a case of good ideas with bad potential consequences. Because I'm sure that at the time that he signed it into law, he had no idea. He had no idea that this would that this would be something that would be put into use by a thrice divorced, multiple adultery committing, admitted sexual abuser, who plays, well, he doesn't so much play footsie with as he dances cheek to cheek with Nazis and Klansmen and the worst elements of our country. Well, that's good. Randy in PA, you issued a Condition 1 alert without an emergency. Steve from Georgia stands, phone question. Can you just simply power off your phone for an hour? You'll probably get it when you power it back up. And see, here's the thing. A cell phone customer can opt out of, say, an alert for a natural disaster. Why would you? Or alerts for missing children. Why would you? But you don't get to opt out of messages from Julius Geezer. There is no way to opt out of a message from a man who has a real tiny, tiny, tiny little hard-on to be an absolute ruler of this country. So, you know, do it or don't do it. Hey, Bob, quit telling us how not to get messages from the Jagoff. I know. Stop it, Bob. Silent R. Lamar said the same thing. How about just turning your phone off? There's nothing in the Reuters article that says that'll stop it. Hey, let's run over and check back in on the phone lines. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Megan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hey, Megan, what's happening?
I had a thought occur to me earlier today, and I wanted to get your opinion on it, and I wanted to run it by the Horn family tonight. And it's probably not going to be any earth-shattering revelation, but it's been something that's been bugging me since at least the presidential election.
Okay.
There's going to be some pop culture references to this, but it's going to lead back to what we, you know, you've pretty much been talking about all week. I am a fan of the TV show The Walking Dead.
Okay.
And a couple of years back, long story short, they were introducing a villain called Negan into the show. Now, Negan was the, you know, he was a, keep in mind, this is end of the world zombie apocalypse fiction, okay? So you got groups of people running around trying to survive and encountering all kinds of, you know, weird people. So the group, the main guy, Rick, was a cop, and basically his character arc was a cop who was trying to survive without the backdrop of law enforcement that he had used, you know, to determine good from bad. And he made some crazy-ass decisions during the, I don't know, six seasons he'd been on, but when he encountered Negan, all of a sudden I noticed that fan groups suddenly were contorting themselves trying to rationalize how Negan was suddenly the hero of the show and that Rick was really the psychopath. And the only reason why I bring this up is because the amount of people doing this, it was literally the week before the 2016 presidential election. And the people that were defending Negan and the people that were defending Donald Trump and trying to rationalize the behavior, it was almost identical. So fast forward to this year, and I'm noticing with another show that I follow that's based on an 80s movie that I grew up with and liked. It's called Cobra Kai, which is an offshoot from the old 80s movie The Karate Kid. That whole movie was about, well, again, long story short, it's about a kid who has to learn karate to get the bullies off his back that have been beating him up. Now I'm noticing with that fandom, with this new show coming out in YouTube Red, which is really, really good, there's a fandom where there's a bent toward trying to make Daniel, who was the hero of the original movie, into some, he was the real bully, and the guy that was beating him up, oh, he's the real hero. I can't tell you how much this has really bothered me, but then I figured out why it was bothering me, and you see what's going on with our government in real life, and it kind of hit me. It's like, have we lost the ability to determine who the bullies are in this country?
Megan, to be honest, that sounds like just classic show running marketing. You know, keep people buzzing. That's kind of like and I cannot confess to know what the plot line is. I watched enough of Game of Thrones to realize that I hated everybody in that TV show, and if a dragon right. would have come along and just gobbled them all up. And it had been, it had turned, and Westeros, or whatever the fuck it was, was a planet with no people and nothing but dragons. I didn't see as how that would be a net loss.
I can see that, but what I'm saying is that the thing that I noticed, like, the market, the shows themselves, like, the people, and I've kept careful eye on this. It's not really coming from the show itself. It's not really coming from the producers. It's not really coming from the writers. It's an actual fan base or subsection of the fan base in both cases. And from what I could tell, it's like the younger generation, I want to say about in their 20s to mid-20s, maybe early 30s. And that really kind of scared the crap out of me. And I'm
yeah, but realistically, Megan, what's the difference between that and who's your favorite Beatle?
The only reason I well,
I mean, I'm not just dismissing your idea, but there, you know, there's always, you know, your favorite, you know, which stooge, you know, Larry Moe, Curly, you know, Shemp. There are Shemp people out there, but no, go ahead.
Well, I get liking a certain character, but they didn't used to kid themselves about what the character, who, and what they were. This seems to be a subsection of really contortionist logic. And again, it's I just making a case of art imitating life.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, you see people walking around. Well, for me, culturally, this is something I can wrap my head around a little bit better because I've got some knowledge of it. Star Wars fans who like to dress up as stormtroopers or Darth Vader, or way back when he was a little kid, our son was fascinated with Darth Maul. These are the bad guys. What is it
about?
What is it about
them? Is one thing, but this would be like if your son came to you and was really trying to sell you on the idea that Darth Maul was really the hero and was really put upon by, I don't know, Obi-Wan. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I'm seeing occurring. I'm not talking about just simply liking the characters, because I can understand that. People are drawn to different characters for different reasons. But for somebody to come up and say, oh, he's really the hero, and he was really put upon, and he was, you know, and that's kind of concerning.
Yeah, and the fact that you said, you know, it was right around the election time, and that was sort of one of the things that made your ears perk up.
Well, it was literally the week before. And there were certain memes going around with putting Trump's head on Megan and Hillary's head on Rick. So when I say there's a bleed through, but again, it's like the only reason why I bring this up is because, like I said, you see this what's going on in the government, and that there are people that are desperately trying to defend what's going on. And I've not really seen that kind of turnaround before. Like I said, it's like if you like a certain character, that's fine, but they didn't used to contort themselves into making, you know, trying to twist around saying, well, so and so's really this.
Yeah, no, I get it, and I'm trying to think if there's anything I watched recently trying to figure out who's good and who. I think there was some aspects of that in American Gods. Certainly in The Man in the High Castle, you spent a lot of time wondering who was good and who was bad. And by the way, that comes back on October the 5th, for people who've been following that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a good series.
Well, we get more of it in 3 days. So.
Awesome.
Well, so, I mean, do you discern any purpose in what you're describing?
Well, I mean, could it for a discussion if anyone else had any thoughts on it. But here's my thoughts on it. I'm a little bit concerned that and I don't know if it goes into history or the founding of our country, because you might have more insight into this than I would. Is there like a certain strain where we worship certain qualities and we see them automatically as good, or we respond to them? And it's really kicking us in the rear end right now as a result. Since there's so much throwback on, like, you know, worshiping the Confederate flag and worshiping Nazism and all this stuff that's coming back, I can't tell like, is it just something that we're something that we respond to as a culture that's, you know, just being thrown up for us to look at and deal with?
As in maybe amusing ourselves to death?
Do we worship bullies? Do we just see them as, oh, well, they have all the power, and then, you know, we just fall to our knees and, you know, because there seems to be a pattern there.
Okay. I think we're, I understand what you're getting at. I would be better off if I had a little bit more conversational approach to the subject matter, and it's just not a program that I'm familiar with. It's just not a program I'm familiar with.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I lost you. I was just
no, you didn't.
I mean,
you didn't lose me. I mean, I get the overall topic. Ron in Raleigh's good at this kind of stuff. He says, I've noticed over the last few years there's been a turn in writing for television, whereas there are no easily recognized heroes. I've stopped watching many programs because I ended up hating everyone. If you can't identify with a character or characters, you generally can't invest in the program, you know, from an emotional standpoint.
Right.
And so maybe...
There's been sort of an attempt to, like, give motivation for the characters to, you know, make them understand the choices that they make. But unfortunately, I think it bleeds into this, you know, no one's really good or really bad. But it's unfortunate because on some levels it can be really good. It could be a good vehicle to kind of break down that kind of behavior so we really understand it. On the other hand, you get, you know, let's worship psychopaths because, you know, they've got all the power and we just need to get in line with what they're telling us to do.
That's a little disturbing. And if you're right, it represents a really... twisted approach to social manipulation. So, I wish I had more knowledge of the program in question, so that. But the larger issue, Megan, of. Well, what you're going back to is the question, does might make right?
Yeah, and I'm seeing a kind of worshiping of that. And again, like I said, it's no real revelation. People are probably going, duh, you know? But it's like, it's not even just what's happening in a localized sense. It seems to be bleeding through, like in pop culture, because I think there's a correlation between art and life. That's just me, you know.
Yeah, and I was just
what we're dealing with.
I was just thinking about, and then lo and behold, Steve from Georgistan read my mind, and he said, when watching Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and so forth, often I find myself rooting for the bad guy, and laughing at things I really shouldn't be laughing at. I think it's Shakespearean by nature, and. And yeah, there's some of that. I mean, I think about Hotspur in the Henry the Fourth series. You know, decisive young man of action, and he's everything that Henry the Fourth's young son, Prince Hal, who prefers to lay up in bawdy houses and cut purses with Falstaff and pistol and drink and raise hell. Hotspur is everything that Henry the Fourth would like to have in a son, but instead he gets Prince Hal, who he fears is going to be as useless as tits on a boar when he gets to be king. And by the time you're, but by the time you're done watching the plays, you realize that Hotspur was an asshole who would have been a nightmare with his hands on power, and you get to watch the change in Prince Hal as he becomes the guy who will eventually become King Henry V. So some of that,
wow,
some of that emotional manipulation is, as Steve perceptively notes, downright Shakespearean. And you can go all the way, you know, you can go all the way back to Sophocles. You can go back to Oedipus. Oedipus is a good and wise king, and then shit starts happening to Thebes. And if you stay with, and you know, and the audience sitting there on their stone benches in ancient Greece are like, fuck, why that? And then you find out that, you know, the gods are punishing Thebes because Oedipus, who had no idea, was actually the king and queen of Thebes' son that they'd tried to expose and have killed. Only he survived, and he came back, he killed his daddy, and fucked his mom. Hence the Oedipus complex that Freud identified. And so, you know, by the end of the play, all those Greeks sitting there in that semicircular amphitheater are all just, I mean, they're cringing from their eyebrows to their toenails because they've got this mental image. Nothing ever happened on stage. They've got this mental image of Oedipus there humping away at Jocasta going, "You're my mama, you're my mama, you're my mama." And for the Greeks, that was just like, "Oh, God, oh, yuck." Because it violated just about every taboo that the Greeks could come up with. And then you understand, wow, you know, even the gods can't tolerate this. I mean, they knew it, that we didn't. And so, you know, I guess it's okay that the gods slaughtered a few people with, you know, a few hundred, maybe a few thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of people with plague in Thebes because of something that happened that they were absolutely not responsible for. Because they were also forbidden from killing the king. You don't kill the king. You don't kill the king.
Right.
And that brings all of those social dynamics into play. That's why they're timeless stories. And some of that is still getting worked out. You know, there are dramatic theorists out there who say that all the stories have already been told.
Right.
And that no matter how good it is or how popular it is or how much money it makes, everything is a variation either on Shakespeare or the ancient Greeks. And, of course, Shakespeare stole freely from people like, dadgummit. Well, the Italian fables, because England was groping toward the Renaissance at a time when the Renaissance had already been a couple of hundred years old in Italy.
Huh.
You know, my Fair Lady is, Pyramus and Thisbe? A long time ago, back in the early 90s.
Not Galatea.
Late 80s, early 90s, there was a mob movie about, and you know, everybody was Italian, and it was called Men of Respect, and son of a gun, it was Macbeth.
Wow.
Only with guns and guys with the, you know, Trump style haircuts. Great movie.
Wow.
But you know what you were tapping into, Megan, I think is the manipulation of archetype, the Jungian archetype.
What you've laid out is that's what a good writer does. Like, I want to say the more modern example, I don't know if you've seen the show Dexter.
No, I haven't.
Okay, that was basically, the main character was a textbook I don't know if it's psychopath or sociopath. And in the course of the show, you find out that the kid, when as a kid, he watched his mother be brutally murdered when he was like 18 months or two years. I don't know exactly what age he was. He basically grew up at, like the cop that took him under his wing because he knew that it was a horrific crime. Found out that that's what he was, and then kind of trained him to kind of basically train him to find evidence to go after the bad guys because he knew he wasn't going to be able to not kill. But he sort of helped him channel it toward the greater good. That was the whole series of Dexter.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's like the people were fascinated because it's like a darker side of humanity, but it was he was functioned sort of as, you know, let's get the bad guys so the good guys can function. That sort of thing I can understand. I mean, there are times you're going to be cringing at it, going, oh, my God, what the heck, and it gets, you know, it's certainly not a show for kids, but that I can get. What I can't understand is, like, you know, going back to the Star Wars example, this would be like, you know, instead of seeing Luke Skywalker as a hero, they're going, no, he was really the, you know, he was really the bad guy. Darth Vader was the hero. And I'm like, hold on a minute. It's this, like I said, I get liking different characters. I like the fandoms. But like I said, they didn't used to kid themselves about who and what they were. So I don't know if there's a subsection of people who are just, like, not self-aware enough about themselves, and they think because they like a certain character, oh, that person has to be the hero. So I'm going to use whatever weird twisted
or maybe it's, as Ron and Raleigh put it, Megan, maybe we live in an age so jaded that we do not believe in heroes.
Oh, wow.
Or, to get even more nerdy, maybe we are moving back toward a more classical understanding of the idea of hero. The mid-20th century idea of a hero, of course, you know, oh, I don't know, Roy Rogers, okay? The Lone Ranger, mm-hmm. Always doing good, always being good, being guided by the pole star of goodness and righteousness and Americanness. And, you know, never doing anything dodgy. Well, again, if we go back to that concept that all the stories have been told, what you find out is that the ancient Greek concept of a hero is somebody that nobody would ever want to be. Because a hero is among the most flawed of people. They do amazing things that are good, but then they are equally capable of doing horrifying things, like slaughtering entire families.
Wow.
And in that case, I'm talking about Hercules. Sure, he performed the seven labors and everything, but then he also went off and killed a bunch of innocent people. And they were trying to convey an idea back then that we should beware of anybody who purports to be 100% this or 100% that or pure, or because we are all of us painfully, achingly human. So maybe, you know, maybe that's a part of it too. Maybe it's easy. You know, we saw the rise of the anti-hero. Somebody who's so flawed that, you know, yeah, they wind up doing the right thing for all the wrong reasons. It could be that that's what you see in Breaking Bad, which I still haven't gotten back into, and I need to. But it just kind of got real heavy for me after a while. You know, a guy who is,
yeah,
who is, mm-hmm, essentially decent, who is presented with a seemingly insoluble situation, and finds, mm-hmm, he has a knack for doing something that will be a net good to his family, but at the same time involves him doing something that is horrifying for the broader culture. I mean, he's actually really more of a hero in the Greek terms than a lot of the other TV character programs are. And
right.
And look, I love those kinds of psycho-emotional dynamics. Because at its best, that sort of entertainment, it kills some time for us, and sometimes we laugh and so forth. But ultimately, art, you know, art is not meant to be a palliative. Art is a challenge to us. Art is an inquiry into what it is to be a human being.
Yeah. Which is why what you tend to see play out in art, I think, you know, is bleeding out from what we're dealing with in real life. So in the ancient concept of a hero, it's, like I said, it seems to be that's what's emerging these days, and I can understand it. But I guess the concern would be some people are not, there's no real depth of understanding of certain things. And so the perception of certain characters tends to be, they perceive it as heroic when in fact it's quite damaging.
That there's always that possibility. Art is dangerous. I think back to when all the precious, good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christians were so upset about piss Christ. You know, with a Christ on a crucifix submerged in a jug of piss. And that weird bastard William Donahue of the Catholic League, who recently stood up in defense of priests raping little children, by the way. He was outraged that this could be publicly displayed in a Christian nation like the. If there's any place on earth that needed to be displayed, it was in a Christian nation like the United States. Because frankly, whether it's Bill Donahue or Brian Fisher or Billy Graham or any of these other hustlers and hucksters, they piss on Christ every day. And it's only become magnified and pressed down and shaken together in the era of Trump when you've got the Graham family and people like Robert Jeffress out there and Jerry Falwell Jr. saying, well, yeah, I mean, he's an adulterer and a fornicator, and he's everything that we've ever preached against, but he's our adulterer and fornicator, so praise Jesus for Donald Trump, you know?
Yeah, and that's going back to in The Walking Dead. It's a running joke in the show that if you ever become the moral compass in the show, you're the first one on the chopping block. You wind up dead. And there's certainly been some characters that had this veneer of morality, and we have to do this and that and the other thing in order to survive. And what you find out later is that they really just like power and control. And again, it sounds a lot like what you just described.
Well, and you know, what you're talking about is resonating, Megan, because I just saw a comment coming from Jordan in the chat room. This is why we need more humanities. People need to learn about framing and subversion in stories, so you don't get people who think Thanos in the Avengers is actually the good guy.
Yeah, that's another example, and I'm glad he brought that up, because there's been a subsection of that they're bringing up. And that, like I said, Bob, it's a pattern. When I talk about Negan in The Walking Dead, I'm talking about a guy who admits that he's broken because he lost his wife from cancer at the start of the zombie apocalypse, decided it would be a good idea to take a baseball bat, wrap it in barbed wire, and create a gang of people that literally go around to neighboring communities who are just trying to survive and take a member of that community and beat them to death in front of that community and demand that they be given the supplies.
What if I told you that that has an actual historical precedent? What if I told you that that really?
Well,
what
that,
if I told? What
that,
if I told you that that, that really, really happened,
that's
Megan?
That's why I wanted to run it by you.
What if I told you that really,
See,
really
that's
happened?
That's why I wanted to run it by you because you would know that.
In the in France, in the 14th century, as the Crusaders came home, and as the plague beginning about 1347. Began to completely shred medieval society, groups of people who had been really, really good Christian soldiers went as long as the people they were slaughtering were innocent Jews and Muslims and the occasional Muslim army in the Middle East, they came back and they realized that they had, well, they developed a taste for doing that. And yeah, they had clubs with spikes on them. And they were simply referred to as the companies. Les compagnies. And they were run by people who were simply, and we know some of them by name. I don't have any of them off the top of my head. But they were run by people who were simply called the captains. And the captains would show up in a lovely little medieval farming community. This is even before the plague strikes. And they'd say, we want all your shit, or we're going to murder the hell out of you. But we're going to rape you for a while first. And this... And
that's
this,
pretty much what he does in the show.
This is... And so, think here for a moment, like somebody who really wants to make a lot of money creating a TV show, but he knows he's never going to be able to sell anybody on something about 14th century France. Well, instead of having them be good Roman Catholic warriors who've gone bad, the captain is a guy who had a different motivation, terrible grief. And instead of villages in the verdant and fertile the fields of France, which was just rich land, that's why they fought over it so much, we'll put it in a post-apocalyptic dystopian world not very far removed from the dystopian world of Europe during the plague. Zombies? Plague? I mean, see, if you have, like what was said in the chat a few moments ago, if you have a really good working knowledge of the humanities, it's good and bad at the same time, because on the one hand, it'll ruin a lot of shit for you, because you look up and you go, oh no, they're just getting this real wrong. On the other hand, it makes things fun, because you go, ha, I know what that is, ha ha ha. They're retelling Oedipus. Oh, look, they're doing plague-ridden France. Only it's zombies now. And you realize that they don't, you know, there's not that much to, that distinguishes them. There's some show on HBO. I think I watched the first episode of it and went, ew, yuck, about a really rich media family in New York. And it was so obviously a veiled reference to Rupert Murdoch and his family that it just went, well, okay, that's what that is. But at the same time, I'm looking at it and I go, oh, hey, we've got some elements of King Lear going on here. Well, I know how King Lear ends. Click. So, you know.
Hello?
Yeah, I hope. I hope that helps a little bit.
Hello?
Yeah, you're right there.
Okay.
If that makes any sense, good. But thank you for bringing the topic to the table, Megan. I appreciate it. It's nice to talk about things that aren't Trump once in a while.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
Hey, you have yourself a great evening. Maybe I can watch The Walking Dead and just see. But it sure does sound like, sounds an awful lot like mid-14th century France, but that's me.
Yeah. I would encourage you to do that because it's the same showrunners that do Breaking Bad.
Okay.
All right.
All right. You have yourself a great evening. Take care now.
All right.
Bye
you
now.
You too, Bob. Bye.
It's our buddy Megan over in Delaware. I need to be more culturally relevant. Where do I find enough hours in the day to watch enough TV to be pop culture relevant? And then I probably have to listen to the new album by some guy who's calling himself a definite article now. It's challenging. Meanwhile, Steve from Georgistan, protagonist versus antagonist. It could be said that the protagonist and the antagonist could be defined by the reader. Of course, upon reflecting, anyone with a conscience would find themselves looking inward and questioning their own morality. Once again, art is supposed to be a challenge. Yeah. And I love the fact that the Avengers was brought up. My primary interest in the Avengers is in Guardians of the Galaxy. I just love that little series, and I hope they haven't fucked it up. But there are a lot of elements in that I look at and go, these comic book folks are counting on people knowing absolutely nothing whatsoever about any sort of literature or culture or anything. Thanos, well, that root word comes from Greek and it means death, okay? Pretty sure. Theta Alpha Nu Omicron Sigma, Thanos. And, yeah, death. Alexander reminds me. Remember how pissed off the holier-than-thou Christians became over the 1989 film, The Last Temptation of Christ? Oh, yeah. And, it's an okay film. A lot more of it could have wound up on the cutting room floor. But there's an ultimate truth tucked away in it, and that's when Paul tells Jesus, hey, if you'd never existed, we would have invented you anyway. Ta-da! Ron and Raleigh, subject line, Thanos. Thanos believes he's the good guy because by killing half the population, he's delivering the remaining population from poverty, famine, and war. You can see his point, but you should still realize his solution is too extreme. P.S. Read the comments on any YouTube TV show site, and you'll see how nasty people really are. I made sort of a vow to myself a long time ago, Ron. Well, a long time ago, but to stay out of the comments. Do not seek the comments. Because you figure out exactly how nasty people are when they're operating with some level of anonymity. But right there, that little synopsis from Ron points out, Thanos believes he's the good guy because by killing half the population, he is delivering the remaining poverty and famine and war. But guess what? They have to die too. Nobody gets to be immortal. And so there he is, Thanos. Thanos is death. Yeah. I don't think I've got the stomach for that. Randy in PA says, let's not talk about Trump. Instead, let's talk about Mitch McConnell's life story. Well, I thought we did that when I was talking about Oedipus. And you're my mother. Yep, it still induces shivers and shudders, doesn't it? By the way, it being the second day of October, it is a Tuesday, That means we have the Green News Report, courtesy of Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And anybody else wanting to get in on the conversation, you're mighty welcome to do so. We've not touched on the great big breaking story of the day, that is that Donald J. Trump and his entire filthy family are and have been for quite some time, apparently, just a nasty old the J. Jamaica Queen's grift and graft operation. What a surprise. I don't know how the New York Times had the nerve to call that breaking news. But they did. But anyway, let's take a break for the Green News Report. If you want to jump into the conversation, multiple ways to do it, toll-free from anywhere in North America, be it Canada, the United States, or Mexico. Still looking for our first call from the top of the pyramid at Chichen Itza. A guy can hope. 844-843-4676. 844-THE-HORN. THEHORN. Or 304-640-2829. 304-574-8178. And, of course, from anywhere on the planet via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never sent a contact request, send one so that we will be contacts in Skype, and we'll be engaging in conversation radio before you know it. And so here we sit. We've still got $60 to go to finish the evening and be even for the first 2 days of October. It would be mighty nice not to to have no deficit whatsoever come prayer meeting, the first prayer meeting Wednesday of October. Can we just knock out $60, please, in the next 38 minutes? It would be mighty helpful. I wasn't planning on being eaten alive by car repair bills, but hey, you don't get, you know, life is what happens when you make other plans. So let's check in and see what kind of hell and damnation Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen have found to share with us. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, October 2nd, 2018.
Climate change is having an impact now, and that impact will only increase more in the future.
Hurricane Florence was the second wettest storm in U.S. history.
In terms of water,
bug experts say they're three times the size of normal mosquitoes.
As North Carolina now grapples with an outbreak of giant mosquitoes. Trump administration uses catastrophic climate change to justify rolling back fuel efficiency standards. Plus,
we have decided to stay unified in spite of the U.S.'s decision to withdraw. This is power.
French President Macron rejects trade deals with any country not in the Paris Climate Agreement.
All of those rejections and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Remember this. I'm an environmentalist.
I don't think that word means what you think it means, Mr. President. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, giant mosquitoes in North Carolina? Really?
Yes, really. As North Carolina begins its recovery from the historic impacts of Hurricane Florence, Governor Roy Cooper has ordered $4 million in funding to control an outbreak of large, aggressive mosquitoes that are the size of wasps that are breeding in these slowly receding floodwaters. Also, Florence has entered the record books as the second rainiest storm in U.S. history. Its 3 feet of rain came in second only to last year's Hurricane Harvey. That means that the top two highest intensity rainfall events in the United States both occurred in just the last year.
Total coincidence.
Nope, that's actually in line with what climate scientists predict we'll see with global warming. GTM Research reports that while it has taken weeks to fully restore power to residents in North Carolina who got their electricity from coal plants, North Carolina's solar plants were up and running the day after the storm hit and sustained only minor damage.
Imagine that.
Meanwhile, an international team of scientists studying the Earth's geologic past warned that we are potentially headed for 20 to 30 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century if we don't act to reduce emissions. The new study in the journal Nature found that temperatures not much warmer than we're seeing today were sufficient 125,000 years ago to melt major ice sheets in East Antarctica, raising sea levels as much as 20 to 30 feet higher than today, which of course would swamp coastal cities and create millions of refugees. But they also note that if humanity manages to cut emissions, global temperature rise would slow down the process of melting the ice sheets.
You know, if you just stopped reading all these studies, trees, none of these bad things would happen, Des.
Meanwhile, in the nation's capital, the Trump administration admits that killing U.S. climate policies will indeed make climate change worse. The Washington Post reports that deep in a regulatory proposal to roll back Obama-era mileage and emission standards for cars and trucks, the administration assumes that on our current course, global temperatures will rise a catastrophic 7 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100.
So they admit that, yes, climate change is happening, climate change is deadly, and then they use that information to support their rollbacks to these regulations.
Right. Rather than spurring action, the administration is instead using it to justify its deregulation spree. They're effectively saying that since fuel efficiency standards by themselves are not enough to stop global warming, it doesn't really matter if the administration rolls them back.
So all of these terrible things are going to happen. We admit it. And yet, if we roll back these regulations, it's not going to make that much of a difference. So don't worry about it. Good luck, planet Earth.
Why bother?
Right.
President Trump on Monday announced a deal had been reached with Canada and Mexico on the existing North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. But trade deals with the European Union could be more difficult. In remarks to the United Nations General Assembly late last week, French President Emmanuel Macron called on UN member nations to reject any trade agreement with countries not signed on to the United Nations Paris Climate Agreement, clearly referencing the United States.
Well, how many are not signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement?
Just the United States.
Huh.
Here's Macron through an interpreter.
Let us also be clear, consistent. Let's, for an example, stop signing trade agreements with those who don't comply with the Paris Agreement. Let's have our trade agreements take on board our environmental obligations.
Now, to be clear, the U.S. is technically still in the Paris Climate Accord. Trump only announced his intention to withdraw starting in 2019, and the earliest that an actual withdrawal could occur would be the day after the presidential election in 2020.
You can't imagine how much I am looking forward to that day. For much more on all of our stories today and the ones that we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, or even Google Play. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. There's gonna be a party
all over the world. Oh, I love that ELO song.
God, isn't that from Xanadu? Wasn't there a lot of roller skating going on during that song? Yeah. Sooner or later, and we have reached the sooner part, there was going to be a reference to the giant mosquitoes, and I'm not making light of them, but, sometimes life imitates art. And consequently, you get... Well, this.
Vince, how long did you actually live in Guatemala?
Oh, he was gone for ages.
I was in the jungle, the bush we called it, for approximately 9 months.
9 months? My God, that really must have been something.
Sheldon, it was unbelievable. I saw things. They have tsetse flies down there the size of eagles.
Really? In the evening, I would stand in front of my hut and watch in horror
as these giant flies would pick children off the ground and carry them away.
My God.
All the things he told us.
Oh, it was an incredible sight. Peasants screaming, chasing these flies down the road, waving brooms. You can imagine the pathetic quality of this, waving these crudely fashioned brooms. These enormous flies as they carry their children off to almost certain death.
Oh, that is just the most horrible thing.
You sure these are flies you're talking about?
Flies. Natives had a name for them. Jose Grecos de Muertos.
Oh.
Flamenco dancers of death.
You took those slides and then they never came out, remember?
They were in that jacket I had
Martinized. That's a shame. I really would have liked to have seen those slides.
Yeah, I left them in a jacket that got Martinized. I tell you, it broke my heart because those slides were the one we had pulled Pulitzer Prize.
the enormous flies flapping slowly away into the sunset. Small brown babies clutched in their beaks.
Wow.
Beaks? Flies with beaks.
Sight I'll never forget. I was stunned, appalled.
What did you do?
What did I do?
As a consultant, what did you do about the flies?
Sadly, there's very little you can do because of the tremendous red tape in the bush.
There's red tape in the bush?
Enormous red tape, gentlemen. These flies, for example, they're protected against pilferage under the provisions of the Guacamole Act of 1917.
Pure genius. Pure genius. And the funny thing is, Vince Ricardo, as likable as he is, he's extremely likable in that film. You can, and it's 1978, 1979, and you can see him, if you watch the whole movie, and it's a treat, there's never a bad time to watch The In-Laws. You can see him in the Trump administration, because he's just a compulsive liar. Nothing he says is true. And poor Dr. Short Sheldon Kornpet is sitting, and he doesn't believe a word that he's hearing. But every time, in a way that scene is a sort of model for our daily reality now, because Dr. Kornpet is grounded in reality. And he knows that Vince Ricardo is sitting there just spinning this outrageous, mendacious, bullshit lie. But he's also absolutely committed to it. And every time there's a challenge of the lie, that was on a roll of film that I left in a jacket that I had modernized. It is terrible. I would have won a Pulitzer Prize. Take any of Peter Falk's lines as Vince Ricardo in that film and try repeating them in a Trump voice.
You can imagine the pathetic quality of these natives and these crudely fashioned brooms. Watching them flap away into the sunset with these babies clutched in their beaks.
And America, normal, fact-based, reality-grounded America, says, beaks? Flies with beaks? Oh, yes.
Oh, definitely, definitely beaks. And the flies are protected against pilferage by the Guacamole Act of 1917. Horrible, horrible. Another terrible trade deal that we made. You know, the world is laughing at us.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of North Carolina and the flies and South Carolina and the mosquitoes, David from South Carolina, Stan, actually sent me a picture of one of the damn things, but there was a problem because there was nothing in the photo to indicate scale. And I think that's because he didn't have a manhole cover handy to set next to it to show the size of the mosquito. On the other hand, up here, we're beset by itty-bitty little teeny-tiny mosquitoes. And there's some biting little bastards. Tormented the hell out of me while I was barbecuing chicken over the weekend. And like I said, we finally had some decent weather. And, oh, that was some... I've talked about how I don't sauce stuff while it's actually on the grill. Well, there's an exception to that rule, and that the exception is chicken. When you're just doing pieces of chicken on the grill, you're not going to be able to have it on there long enough to really, really get the smoke character, smoke flavor into it. You can get some, but not much. And so right at the very end, Ah, you paint the little bastards. You paint them with your barbecue sauce. But you don't, and you let them, you know, you let it bake. You let the sauce bake onto them. And you make sure that you put it on, you know, you turn them so that they're bottom side up. The first side that gets painted is the bottom. It bakes on. You turn it over. You paint the top. You let it sit for a few more minutes, bake it in, and then pull it. And I made homemade barbecue sauce, and then added in a jar of that fruit that Smucker's fruit and honey, strawberry jalapeno spread. It was mind-bendingly good on chicken. I found a special on thighs and legs. And, you know, breasts, the chicken breasts, I don't care. You know, there's more meat there, but not much in the way of flavor. You're gonna smoke a turd in hell for that one, Brother Deacon Asa. When Vince says there's tremendous red tape in the bush, is he referring to Trump's Yeti pubes? I'm asking for a friend. Well, your friend's going to smoke a turd in hell, too. I've been trying really, really hard for about a week now not to contemplate Yeti pubes. And Mario Kart is, of course, ruined forever for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but back to the post-storm assessment of just how bad it is. An outfit called the First Street Foundation did an analysis of the damage in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. More than 51,000 homes were hit by the storm surge. And one in five of those homes, in which water covered more than a quarter of the property, were damaged as a direct and proximate result of sea level rise. They found this out by comparing it to 1970 data. 11,000 homes hit by Florence would not have been impacted had sea levels remained at the levels they were in 1970. But in that short period of time, 48 years, sea level has risen by about 6 inches. And so, through the miracle that is mathematics, we know that 11,000 of the homes hit by Florence wouldn't have been harmed. And that's 20% of the homes damaged are directly as a result of sea level rise. Now, I know that Florida has a law against even speaking about sea level rise. They may have a similar law up in North Carolina, Stan, too. But you'll notice that the sea itself didn't give a rat's ass for what the Republicans in the North Carolina legislature or the previous Republican governor thought about whether or not it should be mentioned. It just went ahead and was sea level rise anyway. And even with things like the Indonesian tsunami that has killed north of 800 innocent human beings, that tsunami was triggered by an earthquake. But even with a tsunami triggered by an earthquake, you have to factor in, well, sea level rise. And when you're talking about a 6-inch rise in sea level, that gets exponentially magnified with something like a tsunami. Because, well, going back to the hurricane, with sea level rise being what it is and climate change being what it is, the storm surges that come with a hurricane are worse than they would otherwise be because the surge starts higher than it normally would have. And you know what? 6 inches of water in a one-inch diameter cylinder ain't that much water. But just as a 6-inch seam of coal in Appalachia, a half a foot, doesn't seem like much coal until you extrapolate it out to a few thousand acres, and then suddenly you're talking about walking around money and billions of tons, millions of tons of coal. Well, the same thing happens on an oceanic scale. And among other things, the bill for Florence is expected to be somewhere between $800 million to $1.2 billion. And that's just to the National Flood Insurance Program. As far as the other insurance losses, $2.8 billion to $5 billion. It gets more terrifying, though, because somewhere around 70% of the homes that were hit by Hurricane Florence were uninsured. Some of those homes without flood insurance didn't have flood insurance because the people who live in the homes that don't have flood insurance didn't think that they were in a storm surge area because the maps, the FEMA flood zone maps, are so out of date that they don't take into account the sea level rise that already exists. And so people don't know that they are at risk every time a hurricane strikes. Then also, according, and it's a fascinating study if you want to go read it. You can find it at firststreet.org, firststreet.org. They also noted that in the past few decades, you know, because money, because population growth, because capitalism, land that had previously been either wetlands or farmlands in the Carolinas, well, they've turned into little McSubdivisions. Some of them are McMansions, but just, you know, ordinary housing developments. And so more than half of the homes that were hit by Hurricane Florence were a result of increased development. A few decades back, it would have been just washing over some tobacco fields or peach orchards or peanut fields or something like that. Now they're people's houses because everybody wants to live there. Because, you know, the government ain't on their backs and they ain't got high taxes. Ron in Raleigh, our Republican legislature. The Republican legislature passed a law in 2011 after they took over forbidding state agencies from mentioning global climate change and ocean rise. Well, there it is. And like I said, oddly enough, like King Canute standing on the shore and commanding the tides not to come in, the sea really didn't give a fuck what the Republicans passed a law about. But they can, you know, they can go to the mouth walking, knuckle breathing freaks who vote them into office and say, see, we ain't bowing down to that there climate change communism. God bless America. You want some paper towels? Oh, it had to happen. Darlene pointing out. Darlene in Connecticut. Subject line, really? No surprise, just a matter of time. Trump mocks Christine Blasey Ford's sexual assault testimony at Mississippi rally. Yep, the old white male power structure, or as Samantha Bee called them, a bunch of shriveled scrotums, I saw that, that was funny, are circling the wagons around Brett Kavanaugh. And meanwhile, Thomas asks an interesting question. Why is U.S. 19 not Interstate 79? I find that strange. Federal highway funds on the table, like Medicaid, is stupid. No hydro at Summersville Dam is stupid, too. I'm tracking an Amazon Smile package that had to go up 19. Hoping Agnes, Margie, and Ferg are all well. Well, thank you, Thomas, and the same to you, my friend. The reason 19 is not 79 is because 79 goes to Charleston. Interstate 79 runs, it terminates in Charleston, West Virginia, or it begins in Charleston, West Virginia, depending on which side you're on, and it ends in Erie, Pennsylvania. And a big chunk of 79 is 19. But at exit 57, it veers west toward Charleston, whereas U.S. 19 goes straight down toward I-77. But maybe the smarter money would be to just make I-77 start there at that juncture with I-79. And, of course, if you drive U.S. 19, you can see a couple of places where there are staging areas for the Mountain View or Mountain Valley MVP, the Mountain Something Pipeline, which, of course, is going to be an environmental disaster and which has resulted in, this is interesting, helicopters flying over things like organically certified farms and dropping fertilizer pellets, chemical pellets, that have actually struck human beings, from a distance, and it hurts, and can ruin the livelihood of an organic farmer that got bombed by the pipeline company. This all really, actually, no kidding, happened. Because what property rights? Merca. Hell yeah. Randy in PA says, here near the Delaware line, we have tiny mushroom flies. I don't think they bite, but they sneak through the screens, and we have to keep the windows closed. They seem to want to fly up one's nose. Captain, it was terrible. The flies flew up our noses. Well played, Randy. Well played. Especially the captain, it was terrible part. Arthur. Yeah, but King Canute didn't tell it right, Bob.
You told it wrong.
Well, apparently the North Carolina legislature didn't do it right either. Or maybe there's no right way to do it. So, by the way, going back to the hurricane zone, because in the midst of all the Kavanaugh filth, somehow or another, this stuff keeps sneaking under the under the radar. Cheros, I'm probably saying it wrong. Feel free to correct me. Cheraw, Cherawa, South Carolina. The Environmental Protection Agency, what's left of it, has been there. And in Cheraw, South Carolina, they found toxic chemicals that were deposited as a result of the floodwaters from Hurricane Florence. And four families there in Cheraw have been told to get the hell out of their homes because the pollutants, the toxins, the poisons were washed into their homes by the storm. They are industrial toxins. We're talking, by the way, about PCBs in detectable concentrations in the living areas of four homes and the crawl space of a fifth. The EPA, much to the consternation of the guy who's running it, claimed that they took immediate action, letting people know after the sampling on September the 25th. The EPA has offered the families temporary accommodations to protect the health of affected families while response actions are evaluated and implemented to remove PCBs from the impacted homes. When you know that your home has been poisoned by PCBs, what level of assurance is there that they've taken care of them that will make you feel good about going back into your home? Isn't that like living with a ticking time bomb under the sofa? Tick, 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 tick. As you wait for Ma or Pa or one of the kids to come back from the doctor, and, well, looks like we got the cancer. The EPA says the temporary housing will be given the families until the contamination is removed. And they're continuing to work in the Cherrall area. And the understaffed EPA is in the process of trying to check more than, 70 Superfund sites that were affected by Hurricane Florence. Yeah. God bless America. In this particular area, the Burlington Superfund site, where a former Burlington Industries manufacturing plant had been sited. It was added to the national priorities list in May, and it was almost completed when Florence hit. And parts of Cherrall were flooded by tributaries of the PD River. The newspaper, The State, interviewed Barbara Bullard Mims, and she said she wished she'd known sooner about the contamination because she's been busy cleaning up her house from the flooding. I should not have been in this all week. I said, there seems to be some urgency to get me out of the house tonight. Am I reading you correctly? And the fella from the EPA said, yes. Now. Yesterday. So, how does Burlington Industries get away with not being responsible for that? Well, because freedom. Because Merca. And, you know, that's just one instance. We won't hear a lot about it over the course of over the course of the recovery. But there will be, I suspect, a lot of people. And, oh, give it 10, 20 years. And you're liable to find out there's all kinds of cancer clusters where the toxic fetid floodwaters from Florence flowed. Yeah. All right, then. It's about 6 minutes before the hour, and I guess we're not going to finish the last $60 of fundraising this evening, but thanks very kindly to Steve for making the challenge early on, and thank you to Larry, and thank you to Matt in San Francisco for answering the call on that and getting $40 of it knocked down. Oh, wait, I could be wrong. Hey, there's Arthur. Thank you, Arthur. That means we're down to $55. Thank you so very much indeed. So maybe overnight the other $55 will roll in. Hate talking about it. Someday if we get those $410 a month subscribers, I won't talk about it anymore. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed. In the meantime, tomorrow is prayer meeting Wednesday. Oh, by the way, program note on the way out the door. Come Friday, we will have a two-hour program instead of a three-hour program. That means we'll start Friday on the front porch. We're almost right out of the gate, if that's okay with Sparky. I'll be filling in for Malloy at 9 p.m. And hopefully everybody will tune in. We'll have a real high, good old time. That's Friday. As for tomorrow, I don't expect not to be here. But one never knows when one is taking one's vehicle to the garage. Because I know there's a bearing that has to be replaced and the brake line that has to be replaced. And Jesus. I hope I'm here. If I'm not, I'll try to tweet and Facebook and let y'all know that I won't be. So that's just a sort of a heads up. So that's it for this evening, this Titanic Tuesday. Maybe we will have time tomorrow to go into the history of tax skullduggery of Le Clan Trump, La Famille Trump. But like I said, I'm hard-pressed to see that, the fact that it's a family, really? A family full of grifters. The devil, you say. I'm having a hard time seeing that as, you know, breaking news. But still, maybe we'll go into that. Or who knows what'll be blowing up then. But maybe we'll find out that Brett Kavanaugh was involved in yet another bar brawl. By the way, I don't think he was 21 when he was in that bar. Once again, yeah. All right, so thanks to everybody who keeps this program on the air. Thank you so very much to all of our subscribers again. Thank you very much indeed to, like I said, Arthur and now James and Steve and Matt and Larry this evening. We're down to $45 to go to finish the evening. Thank you, James. So thank you, and thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaged in this ongoing conversation. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff in the chat room this evening. Thanks very kindly to Sparky and to Steve from Georgistan. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you to Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.